I'm Greg Johnson. Merry Christmas and welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I am back with Jim Goad, who's one of my favorite guests on this show, and we are going to be talking about Answer Me and the zine culture of the 90s, his karaoke fundraiser, and your questions, of course. So, Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, everybody.
And if you would like to help out with our annual fundraiser, and if you'd like to send a question in to Jim or a karaoke request, those start at $100. You can do that through Entropy. Go to entropystream.live/countercurrents. Hit the green button. Leave a paid chat. We're not streaming there, but we are gratefully taking your donations. And it's one of the few places where you can use a credit card to send money to us. You can also use Cash App. It's $countercurrents without the hyphen. And we very much appreciate that as well. And of course, we will take your DLive tokens. You can also send tips through Odyssey. And any way you choose to help out is very much appreciated. We've got a whole bunch of fundraising to do. I was just talking to Jim about this before we went online. We're under 75% of the way towards our annual goal, and we've got just about 2 weeks left in the year to do it. So your support is much needed and very welcome. So I want to talk to Jim about Answer Me. And before I do that, I want to give a little bit about my background with Answer Me. I first heard of Jim Goad and Answer Me in the year 2000. I became friends with a fellow in Atlanta who was a connoisseur of dark things. And he was also a person with extremely radical ideas, but he was a connoisseur of dark things. He was drawn to dark things. He was drawn to the dark things in life. And he admired Jim Goad because Jim would look unflinchingly at very dark things and find the humor in it and could laugh and rise above it. And that is what I found very powerful about Answer Me as well. He deals with dark topics. There's an issue on rape. There's an issue on suicide. There's an issue on serial killers. There are four issues in total. These are not things to celebrate, but these are car wrecks. These are civilizational car wrecks that you can't resist looking at. And when you look at this stuff, you've got to find a way of rising above it, or it's just a scar. It's a trauma. And I really admire his ability to look at dark things and rise above it with humor. So Answer Me, if you're thinking about a last-minute stocking stuffer for your normie Republican cousins, don't go there. That's not going to fly. Answer Me is something unusual. It's something dark. It's something for a small audience of people who want to look at the dark things in life and rise above it with laughter. And I was immediately impressed with Jim's writing and some of the other writing in Answer Me. I was amazed at the drawings by Nick Bugis and other illustrators in there. It's an absolute landmark of 90s zine culture, and it's back now, reprinted. So, Jim, let's talk a bit about the new edition, and then I'd like to go into the history of Answer Me, going back decades now.
You mean this right here?
Yes.
This is 5 pounds. It's hardcover. We've got the end leaves and everything. The paper is all glossy. I'm dropping things. We've got the rape game fold out. We've got my proudest achievement, Chocolate Impulse, which was, when Answer Me first came out, I didn't even know what a zine was. I thought it was a magazine, but we got sucked into this zine world and we became the top dog. Like, everyone worshipped us for like one or two issues. Then they got jealous and this crab in a bucket syndrome emerged and they started sniping at us and saying we're talentless, racist and everything. I got the idea around the time the fourth issue came out. It's like, why don't we do a hoax zine? And this is, I understand this is paranoid and touchy and everything, but I got a friend in Freeburn, Kentucky, right on the Tug River between West Virginia and Kentucky. He's in McCoy country, West Virginia side's the Hatfield side. Get a P.O. box for us. We're going to get together the worst poetry and musings and drawings that Debbie did during college, put it together in a zine, pretend it's published by a pair of interracial lesbians who are being hounded by the local rednecks in Kentucky for being interracial lesbians. But the little surprise we put in here was an anti-Answer Me rant, just saying that we're talentless. And of course, they came on to Debbie saying, leave him, join the, you know, join the rainbow and everything. And we sent it out to everybody who criticized us. And, you know, from this P.O. box, we also got squid. The new edition doesn't have the squid wrapping. We got fresh squid from Bond's restaurant and Bond's supermarket in L.A., smeared it on the inside page and acted as if the lesbians had smeared the vaginal fluids on it, sent it out. And everyone who said we were talentless hacks said this was brilliant. You really stuck it to them. What we were doing back then was just appealing to their proto-woke sensibilities. We said the right things. We made it as crappy as possible. But you realize with these certain people, like if you say the right things, it doesn't matter if you don't have talent. Like if you're on their side, you're talented. And I think that's existed. There's a butt plug on the back here. That's existed to this day. And it's something I talk about in my last feature, but it has Chocolate Impulse, everything else. But the big thing, I mean, Nick Bugis did the front and back cover. He also, am I permitted to show the Andrea Dworkin drawing here?
Yes. Okay. It's almost the definition of obscene. I haven't looked at this in decades, and it's still seared into my memory. Andrea Dworkin's armpits drawn by Nick Bugis. Yeah, yeah, you can show it.
It's just, there she is. Nick Bugis drawing there. There's lovely Andrea Dworkin.
Oh, God. Yeah. It's exactly as I remember it.
But God, it's only been available for like a month and it's 40% gone. So get them at jimgo.net if you want them. These always become collector's items and always are worth much more than their cover price. So
yeah, it's going to be on eBay by the middle of next year. Of course, I don't recommend buying works of art as investments. I recommend buying them as things that you can enjoy. But yeah, it's going to maintain its value, folks. You can pass it on as an heirloom. I got mine, and you should get yours. And I want this to sell out. I want this to be a big.
The thing I was worried about was because we found Asian printers, and it was Nick's drawing of this Asian guy here. That because Asians are touchy about Asian stereotypes, but we got it through. I guess I should talk about the like just getting this printed because we had trouble getting it printed 30 years ago. Good Lord, the place printed it in Canada 5 years ago, no problems. That sold out like it always sells out. About 2 years ago, I said, hey, we got another edition. Cool. And they're like, yeah. So the day I was going to make the down payment, they said, no, we can't take it. We got an order from corporate that we can only print full color on the inside. I figured that was a nice way of saying you're a Nazi woman beater. We're not going to print your dumb hate book. And I called the guy a couple times. He never answered. I figured I was right. Then I called a year later. They said, no, that guy died. We'll print it if it's color. I'm like, you sure? And they said, yeah. So Nick especially, but Sean Tedjerachi did it. And we found some of like the original pictures of Son of Sam, just replaced them with the color. Spent a year. Okay. And, you know, this was from a slide that was sent to me in like 1990, full color shotgun suicide. Everything's colorized. So it took a year of work to do that. Then the day we were going to make the down payment, sent it to him. And it reminded me of when they asked Sal Mineo in Rebel Without a Cause, why'd you kill the puppies, John? Jim, what's in the book, Jim? Like, and I'm like, you idiot. Like, I told you it was in the book. It was printed 5 years ago. No, we can't print it. It's offensive. So we wasted all that time. Finally, someone tipped me up. It was Chip Smith at Nine Banded Books. He's like, well, here's a place in Shanghai. This is what really makes me black-pilled. I hate using these terms, but about the state of America and the West right now, because dealing with this guy in Montreal, every question, he either like passed it off to someone else, bungled it, didn't answer it. Within 12 hours, the guy in Shanghai, the other side of the world, and I'm sure English wasn't his first language, diligently answered every question. The price was like one-third of it was in Canada. Everything was ready to go, but then the Chinese government stepped in and said, no, it's too offensive, too much sex and too much violence. Then we found a place, and I got a print broker, found a place in South Korea. Koreans are legitimately the only ethnic group I can say I genuinely dislike en masse. Like, I've had really bad experiences with Koreans. But I think they've redeemed themselves. They're the only place on the planet that printed this. And they did a fantastic job with that Asian diligence. There you have it. That's what happened. It was very goaty in just getting this thing printed this time around. And was it? It was back in June, PayPal yanked my account with no explanation. So it's kind of miraculous it's being sold at this point.
That's great. You know, if the Koreans had any questions about the Asian caricatures, you just say, oh, those are Japanese or those are Chinese.
There you go. And they're just say it's totally another Asian.
With that. Yeah.
Right.
Oh, it's your enemies. It's those other Asians. Oh, very well. So that's interesting. So when did you actually begin Answer Me? When was the first issue? And what were you doing before Answer Me? Were you being published before Answer Me?
Well, the long answer is I never wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be an actor for some stupid reason. Got accepted at NYU to study with Stella Adler, who taught De Niro and Brando. It was a dream come true, but my working class parents said, no, that's a fag's profession. We're not going to pay a dollar for this. So I drove a cab and went to school for journalism. And when I was taught about, I mean, didn't have much interest. I wanted to become a rock critic. That's how low my goals were. But when journalism was explained to me, like pure journalism, when you treat it like a science, you don't impute any emotions or motives to anybody. You just report what you can see, what you can measure. Any statement of fact, you hang it on someone else. I still admire that whole belief system, or it's almost like a scientific method, but I didn't realize that most journalists don't practice that. And when I started writing, the other thing too is like, this was before the internet and you had to have something done by the morning. You could spend time on an article. I'd bust my ass inside and out doing it, you know, comb it over, rewrite it. Every time there'd be like one sentence I'd focus in on. I'm like, wow, I wrote that? Pretty clever. Maybe I'll keep writing. Always would always be what they took out. I mean, like they had radar for it. They could hone in on it. I think the final straw was one of the Trillings at Details magazine wanted me to write something, and he bounced it back to me. I'm like, forget about this. I'm just going to take everything that wound up on the cutting room floor, amalgamate it. Everything that was too much for them, I'm going to put it into a magazine. And I did, and it was 1991. The first issue really didn't have much of a theme. A lot of it was reprints from stuff like the pure versions, the non, how do you pronounce that? Bowdlerized version? Bowdlerized? The non-expurgated, with them taking the good stuff out, everything pure.
Bowdlerized.
Bowdlerized, okay. Yeah. And first issue didn't have much of an impact or a theme. We got the only promotion I ever did for Answer Me was I sent out a dozen review copies of the first issue. There was a zine in LA called Ben is Dead from these trust fund hipsters. They made it like we were the trust fund hipsters. And there's something about my working class background. It's like that's blood libel. I went after them. But like, if you notice, there's a shift in tone between the first and second issue. The second issue, we basically became murderers, more or less. It was just pro-violence. We'll kill anybody who says anything about us. And it was magical. We had to get the second issue printed four times. And then the third issue. And we were in that tiny pond in the zine world. We were pretty much the top two, me and Debbie. Debbie didn't do much of the magazine as far as page count, but she was, I mean, she died 20 years ago of ovarian cancer. She had this gift of unvarnished negativity. She was the most negative person I've ever seen in my life. It was absolutely genuine. You could compliment her and she'd say, okay, here's a story. There's a guy from Portland, sincere guy. He was in some kind of dumb satanic band or whatever, but when she was going through chemo, she was at some club and she had her chemo wig on, and he came up to her and he's like, I just want to tell you that, you know, it sucks what happened between you and Jim, but you've been an inspiration to me, and Answer Me is going to live on. And as people tell me the story, the whole time he's talking, more and more, she's clutching harder and harder onto her purse. And he finally gets done with, you know, this unvarnished praise. She looks at him like, are you out of your fucking mind? And just walks away. That's like a classic. She was the most negative person. And it comes through there. She was like the color man. She was like the Flavor Flav, and I was Chuck D. She, without her pure hatred, it wouldn't have been what it is. And people always say you're going to do another one, but that'd be kind of cheesy because Answer Me depended on me, her, and Los Angeles at that point in time. I never want to go to LA again. Debbie's gone. So it would be like Oh, The Temptations, starring The Temptations bass player. Like it would be a mockery of the, you know, I'm off doing other things now. Hopefully, I mean, not as, I think the one thing when I look back at this, it's like, yeah, I was legitimately unhinged, but I think it helped the magazine. Now, when you're a felon and you have a kid to take care of, you can't, and it sucks. You can't really be a sociopathic, but I try to compensate in other ways.
So the first issue was 1991.
Yeah. How each four you... issues, 91, 2, 3, and 4. The first issue had no theme. Then it was murder, suicide, and rape. And fortuitous timing. The serial killer issue hit right when Jeffrey Dahmer was the biggest story in America. Mm-hmm. The suicide issue hit when Jack Kevorkian was the biggest story in America. The rape issue was a reaction to Riot Girl and the I don't know what wave of feminism. I hope there's finally a wave that drowns them all, but it was a reaction to Riot Girl and this intense psychotic where they'd only give out lyric sheets at these punk shows to the girls. And it was a reaction to that. And then also a reaction. I didn't understand why people thought Charles Manson was cool, but date rape wasn't. It's like, I think if you held a gun to most people's heads, they'd say, yeah, rape me. Most people, I think it's worse to kill somebody than to rape someone, but gender discourse had warped everyone's mind to the point where, no, rape was worse.
Right.
And then just the idiocies of things such as rape has nothing to do with sex. It's about power. And I said in that issue, I'm like, well, if that has nothing to do with sex, there's an awful lot of penises and vaginas that need explaining.
Right.
Like, how can you deny it? It's by definition a sexual act. And it was one of these nonsense statements like race is only a social construct, but racism somehow magically is everywhere, or alcoholism is a disease. None of this made sense. That's kind of why I write. It's like I just stand up screaming. It's like, no, you got it all wrong. I kind of regret deciding to become a writer because it doesn't, like I'm sure you know and anyone else who's tried to speak truth about any matter to anyone, people don't care. People want to be on the good side, whether it's the true side or not. So.
Right.
Looking back, I wish I'd become a lawyer or a doctor or something where I didn't have to kill myself writing and get frustrated how people just aren't emotionally capable of processing truth.
One of the things that inspired me to want to be a writer when I was a teenager, at least think about being a writer, was picking up a couple of paperback volumes. I don't even know where I got them. They were used at the time. Beat up paperbacks of the Rolling Stone record guides from the late 60s and early 70s. And these are pocket paperbacks. And I read through this just because I wanted to, you know, get reviews of things. Yeah. And I was taken by the writing. I really liked Lester Bangs. I thought he was a quite clever writer. And I think there was a guy named, I think his name was Cornyn. I think he's still alive. He wrote in Los Angeles as a music critic. And when I would read their reviews of things that I knew very well, and see how apt their language was at describing something that I had only experienced and felt, I was really impressed by that. And I was also impressed by the wit of it and the sort of bohemian posturing as well. Were there particular music critics that you admired?
Because I mean, Lester Bangs was good. There's always Hunter S. Thompson, the most overrated writer. But the one I liked of Rolling Stone was a guy, Charles M. Young. He was funny and dark, and he had a band called Iron Prostate, which was all these older rock critics playing rock music. Uh-huh. But I think a bigger influence on me was the unheralded Cream magazine, C-R-E-E-M, out of Michigan. Oh, yeah. I think Lester Bangs actually had more to do with them than with Rolling Stone. And I think Richard Meltzer wrote there, Rick Johnson, but they had just a great attitude about everything. And I remember, not sure if you're familiar with Wanda Jackson, the queen of rockabilly, another unheralded person, but I first heard of her in Cream. I'm standing at a 7-Eleven in Media, Pennsylvania. And they said she sang so hot, you could fry an egg on her G-spot. Descriptions like that, like really lurid, too much information kind of descriptions. I think that was a much bigger influence on me than Rolling Stone. But yeah, I want to be a rock critic. Like what a horrible and what a like shelf, like short shelf life. I'm glad I got beyond that. I just became a hate monger for 30 years.
Right. So you did four issues. Did you have issues 5, 6, and 7 sort of sketched out in your mind? Did you have other themes that you wanted to explore and answer?
Issue 5 was going to be the race issue.
Ah.
And Yeah, I remember Sean Partridge was going to write something called Blame the Jews. And like, you wake up, you have a toothache, you blame, like, just blame the Jews for everything. I think Boyd Rice was going to write something. It was like the Black Heroes Hall of Fame about how they always pick like rapists and murderers like to support. But nothing more fleshed out than that. And what happened was, I mean, the whatever bad mojo answer me had accumulated at that point, because when issue 4 came out, we picked it up in a moving truck along with the first Answer Me anthology, the first 3 issues, and hightailed it up to Portland and had no idea that that would be the Bermuda Triangle for us. Because only about 3 months after getting to Portland, some deluded little college feminist was freaked out by the rape issue in Bellingham, Washington, trotted it to a rape crisis center. They took it to the local DA, who was a Mormon, and it was this weird alliance of radical feminists and uptight Christians who brought obscenity proceedings, not against me, but against the people who sold it in Bellingham, Washington. And that got national. I mean, the day that the news broke, it hit the AP wires. I had 55 answering machine messages. Everybody wanted to talk to me. I kept mum for a couple of weeks because I didn't know what I was, because I wasn't on trial. And I'd never have a problem getting myself in trouble. But if I get someone else in trouble, I'm a little more considerate. Mm-hmm. But I pretty much got the defense, all of their witnesses. We had Donnie the Punk, who'd been raped 65 times in jail. The first weekend he was in jail for protesting the Vietnam War. Girl cartoonist Molly Kiley. I was a teenage victim of date rape. She wrote about, you know, her experience being raped in the ass by her boyfriend. And they had those as witnesses. I couldn't see the trial because I was a potential witness. They thought I was too crazy to put on the stand. But from everything I hear, they like the DA is like, no, you're not dealing with your rape trauma, Donnie, the right way. He said the same thing to Miley. Like the DA was trying to dictate to these actual rape victims how they should deal with it. Donnie the Punk, who had an IQ of 175, he said, he told the DA there have been hundreds of profiles on me. This was the guy who got it right. The jury thought it was obscene, which means it has no literary value. And it's, I got to tell you how undignified and insulting it is. You have these people who probably can't read like a matchbook cover, and these mall rats who haven't read anything since they were forced to read Catcher in the Rye in high school. You know, I don't judge your sweatsuits, like, but that's when you're under the gun legally, you start to realize how totalitarian the law is. Like an opinion can get people put in a cage. Like what other like area of law? Because that's an opinion, whether it has value or not. You can't prove that, but it's one of those. I think it was Justice Potter Stewart, and it still stands. Like his definition of obscenity was, I don't know it. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. It's like, well, you can say that with racism, can't you? And they are. And sexism. If you can just make it up. You know, who would have thought that microaggressions would be a thing 30 years ago? But it's just gotten worse and worse. But I think I was unique, and I think the only one I can think of back then that was getting it too was David Cole for being the world's only Jewish Holocaust revisionist. But I traced it back further than that. I think the first guy who really got canceled for being, I mean, politically incorrect is such an antiquated term, but Earl Butz, B-U-T-Z, he was the Secretary of Agriculture under Gerald Ford. And he said something along the lines, he told a joke. I don't know if he told it in public or someone just reported him for it. He said, there's three things the coloreds want. Tight, are we okay with profanity here? I'm not sure what's the D-Live.
Well, no, it's a, you're quoting an American.
Okay, he said, there's three things the coloreds want. Tight pussy, loose shoes, and a warm place to shit was his joke. I mean, it's just kind of like a statement of fact, as far as I can tell. But he lost his job as Secretary of Agriculture. Then you had the Jimmy the Greeks and the Al Campanis, like a lot of sporting guys. Mm-hmm. So, but I was on the kind of the cusp of that. What was fascinating to me, too, was it was a Usenet group called Alt.Zines, and that's where everybody talked about the zine world and what was happening. When I announced that Answer Me was going on trial for obscenity up in Washington State, everyone's, oh, those redneck Republicans. It's like, no, this was a rape crisis center and college feminists who wanted to put people in jail for wrongthink. And that's around when the cultural power tilted. Because, yeah, when I was a kid, it was the Republicans who were burning records. And my theory is I don't think the left or right are any more inherently totalitarian than the other. I think whoever has the power is going to be the censor and the, you know, the bully. That's just the way things work.
So how did you promote Answer Me before the internet?
Nothing. It spread by word of mouth. The first issue, I sent out 12 copies of the first issue. Otherwise, it spread and distributors started contacting us. One of the reasons you can't get this book anywhere but through me, because I don't know if people realize that. If you sell a book for $50, the distributor gets 25 of that, which is insane. Just for, ringing it up at the cash register, they get half of the cover price, where you put all the work in, you paid to have it printed, you paid to have it sent to them. This way, I'm just taking all the money this time. I've been a really dumb businessman my whole life. This time, it's like, all right, I'm gonna keep it for myself. Let no merchants get in the way in the middle this time.
Absolutely. I think that's wise. And if you're in business for yourself, you also sell all your other books. You print and sell those. You autograph copies. And all that's at jimgo.net, people. If you are interested, I think you should check it out.
I'm not sure if you see my signature. It looks like I have Alzheimer's or something. I mean, I've been on keyboards for so long. I look like a dementia patient. I used to get, because I can't write cursive anymore, so I kind of just fake cursively signing my name. And then I, in all caps, I put Jim Goat underneath it. You can't even read the all caps at this point. It's pretty sad.
Well, there's still... treasured. I have many autographed Jim Goads. Can you tell me what's the meaning of the title, Answer Me? How'd you come up with that?
One of the original titles was really stupid. It was going to be called Slimy Pizza. I'm glad I didn't choose that. Yeah. But I realized, it was John Waters wrote an essay once that stuck with me. He said, to be glamorous, or if you want to, make an impact, take your ugliest feature and make it attractive. Like if you have bad acne, rub potato chips on your face and make it worse. I'm like, okay, what's my most unseemly feature? I've got a volcanic temper.
Right.
And Answer Me. And it's like stylized. It's always spelled with the Answer Me in all caps and then M-E exclamation point. I realized when people weren't being straight with me, I'd eventually erupt and scream, Answer Me. Give me a straight answer. That's
right.
Where it came from. Yeah.
Well, I bet you had to do that a bunch with these printers in the recent saga. Just tell it to me straight. What's going on here?
That's why when they first said, no, we can only print color, I assumed they were lying to me, but they weren't. But then 2 years later, after we spent all this time colorizing it, they're like, no, it's still too offensive. But we had problems. Way back, there were a bunch of places that wouldn't print it. The third issue, the suicide issue and the rape issue, it was intended to be ghastly. And I mean, we weren't trying to glamor. I mean, anyone who came away with the idea that we were glamorizing rape or trying to turn on sexual offenders, you got to ask what's in their head? Cause that's not what I saw. But I remember when we found China Times printers in San Gabriel, California, they printed the third and the fourth issue. We bring in the rape issue and these guys, there's an actual picture of this hairy ass with a turd coming out of the, and they just look at it and they take out their rulers and then they start calculating what percentage they're going to have to shoot this at, unfazed. They didn't care. They were just purely mercantile. So yeah,
and we wound up other kinds of stuff they were printing, right?
If they were who the hell? I mean, they did like a Chinese community, for LA Chinese language newspaper every week too. But they didn't care about these dumb ghost people. Like they just wanted our money. But yeah, I guess we wound up having to get Asians to print it again.
That's interesting. Gadius Maximus writes in with $10. Thank you. Jim, how did you manage to score all those interviews for an underground zine as a virtually unknown writer before the internet?
I was just persistent. I remember with Al Sharpton, God, it was months again and again and again. But that was with I was a wigger, and I have to clarify, I didn't rap. I didn't talk black. I just liked hip hop music and thought they were, I was uneducated enough to buy the whole everything about them being oppressed and we're holding them down from their glorious potential. But every last rapper that I ever interviewed, and we're talking about maybe 18 of the real high profile ones back then, every one of them was late, sometimes by months. The only one who apologized was KRS-One, but he was still late. That was another thing in my red pilling. I'm this Ernest Wigger, and I remember doing like articles for the LA Reader about, you know, the homeless crisis and the incarceration crisis. Invariably, most of the people that I interviewed were fuck-ups. And I started thinking, yeah, you kind of deserve it, just not because, you know, it's right to put someone in a cage, but you're hopeless. Like, you don't learn from the 14th arrest, you know. And I started realizing with these rappers, it's like, against my better judgment, it's like, these people are so dumb, agonizingly dumb. And this was around the same time the bell curve came out. And it's like confirmed my suspicions. And in answering number two, there's a reprint of an article that Playboy mangled about Vietnamese gangs in Orange County. On the flip side, I went down to Orange County, Westminster, and Garden Grove with big Vietnamese populations every weekend for 6 weekends in a row, and hung out at the clubs and did drive-throughs with the, or drive-arounds, not drive-bys with the cops, whatever they drive. They had some special term for driving with the cop. But I was impressed by these Vietnamese kids who like grew up around napalm and bombs, and they get here and all of a sudden, you know, within a year or two, they've got mansions and they own restaurants and they have Maseratis. That didn't align with what I've been taught, that this was a white supremacist country and we were holding, because the Asians were excelling in everything. Another thing around the same time, and it's not an answer to me, but it's something I wrote for Tacky's called The Day I Left the Left. I had a paid gig as an editor at the LA Reader, and I decided to do an article about this weird phenomenon. I don't think it exists anymore. Mexican stoner gangs from the late 80s. What was fascinating to me was they weren't the typical cholos who have a whole look and they're dyed-in-the-wool Mexican pride. These were Mexican kids who were trying to assimilate by being into heavy metal. They'd have long hair. They listened to Slayer and Metallica. And to me, it was this poignant. It's like, what a weird way to assimilate. And there were even rumors some of them would inject themselves with dyes to make their skin lighter. I hung out with these guys. They welcomed me. There was one guy who looked like a Mexican Gene Simmons. His gang name was Wimpy. He was a really likable guy. There was this other gang called the Hicks Boys. Hung out with them, smoked angel dust with them. Then after the article came out, I got fired for the article because the publisher said, these people are scumbags. Like, I don't even know why you're writing about them. You know, a liberal, this guy. And I said, well, maybe, James, if you'd grown up with choppers, police choppers, you know, with lights tailing cholos, with shirtless cholos with machetes running through the hood at night, maybe you'd be a little traumatized. Maybe you'd be just like them. Didn't matter. But what I think the actual day I left the left was, I went over to East LA, which I think these days is 98% Mexican. I went to buy weed from this gang that I'd written the article about and that I'd lost my job over defending. And there was only one of them there on this corner on a Saturday morning. He's threading a needle to give himself a tattoo. He's like, you fucked up, Holmes, man. We don't like what you wrote about us. You know, you said, don't call us Mexicans, call us stoners. I'm like, I have it on tape. What are you talking about? Like, I lost my job over you guys. He's like, you're glad, you know, you should be lucky it's only me because we would fuck you up, home. And I remember, and it just came out of me like diarrhea, or like I call niggeria. I got back in the car because this guy's threatening me and I risked something for him. I said, you're here because you're too dumb to do anything else. It just came out of me. And my entire brainwashing, because I thought, you know, if these poor young Mexican kids only had the chance to be a politician or run a corporation, they'd do it right. It's like, no, they'd be probably worse. It's not an accomplishment not screwing people over through your corporation if you're too dumb to run a corporation. So that was the day that everything changed. And it was, a year later, there was an answer me out. I lost that job. I'm like, I don't like being edited. I'm just going to do it myself. And there was a magic to it. But then again, you get into legal trouble and you get blocked by censors and distributors and everything. But still would rather, it's better than still just gritting my teeth being edited and bowdlerized, is it? Bowdler?
Yeah, Bowdler. Yeah, he did an edition of Shakespeare, I think, with the...
Oh, okay. He took out the dirty parts?
Yeah, the dirty parts and the violent parts. I don't know what was left, honestly. Anyway, that's really interesting. So after Answer Me, the fourth issue, why did you stop after four?
We took it up the minute it came out. We were on a truck to Portland, moved to Portland. Within 3 months, it was in January, I got a letter, and I always remember this. It was the college feminist, and she said, you know, do not sell this or anything like it again. She said, you don't want the blood of another Oskowitz on your hand. It's like, I think she meant Auschwitz, but she spelled it O-S-K-O-W-I-T-Z. And so we got yanked into that, and it was this series. Portland was the Bermuda Triangle. Within 3 months of moving there, this high-profile obscenity proceeding started. Only a couple months after that, I was subpoenaed to go testify in court in D.C. in the trial of Francisco Martin Duran, who shot at the White House in the fall of 94, fired 29 bullets, hit the White House, was trying to kill Clinton, quoted me in a line and answer me. Then there were three British neo-Nazis, and they were kind of like fashion fetish goth Nazis. It was a kid, 22 years old. He worked in a potato chip factory. The two girls were 22 as well, but they had both had degrees in astrophysics. They came to the U.S. They were looking, I forget who the white nationalist guy they were looking for. They never found him. They were alleged to be stalking Bob Dole to kill him. And it's like, wait a minute. So my writing on this stupid little magazine has been blamed for an attack on the White House where Bill Clinton was residing, and then Bob Dole. So I was linked to assassination attempts on both major presidential candidates in 96. That's
right.
That's kind of a dubious accomplishment, but it's an accomplishment. Yeah. And so there was all this maelstrom of hell and trauma and scandals. And then in early 97, Debbie, who was the Flavor Flav, who was like the solid black heart of Answer Me, she got diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Now, backing up what's super creepy, because there's so much lore and bad mojo about Answer Me. So the rape issue caused an obscenity trial. The murder issue was blamed for a shooting on the White House, but the suicide issue, three different things. One was the three kids who killed themselves and sent me their life. One of them sent me their life savings. The love triangle soured. The guy's affections leaned toward the other girl. I got a call on my voicemail message from the other British girl asking where to send her money. I called her back, and that's all she wanted to know. And a week later, I have the press ask me, what do you have to say about these British kids who killed themselves? So that was a huge scandal. That was a link to Answer Me. That picture of the shotgun suicide I showed you, that was according to artist Jim Blanchard, who did the Hitler cover. And he did a good Hitler. Let's find the Hitler here. He was an artist for Fantagraphics in Seattle. There's the Hitler cover of Answer Me number 3. But he got backstage at the last Nirvana concert in Seattle by handing out Answer Me number 3 and some Fantagraphics comics. He said he saw Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love all snuggled up on a couch in the green room reading the suicide issue, which had a shotgun suicide. That was the centerfold. It was about 2 or 3 months before Kurt Cobain blew his head off. Not sure if it was related or not, but the most ghoulish, creepy coincidence with Answer Me number 3 was Debbie called. We printed the transcript of the conversation with Jack Kevorkian. Her mom had died of ovarian cancer, which it's highly hereditary. In 1989, she was diagnosed with a kiwi fruit-sized benign ovarian tumor that dissolved. We never wanted kids. I begged her to get her ovaries removed. She didn't. Maybe she had a death wish. But 4 years after we printed this, her telling Jack Kevorkian she has ovarian cancer, what do I do? She got ovarian cancer and died. And I got involved in an affair and wound up beating up the psychopath and went to prison for 2.5 years. So when I came out in the year 2000, it was clear to me that Answer Me was over. What else could I have done? I used to joke, like, I'll be walking down the street and like accidentally catch a baby as it falls out of a burning building. Like there'll be some unintended act of heroism, because I don't know how I can top all the trauma and weirdness that happened with these four issues.
Right. Yeah, if you did issue number 5 without Debbie, it would have been like the Beatles without McCartney or something like that. Or yeah, exactly. So when did you start writing for Talkie? Was that in 2010 or 2011?
2010. It was because I got out. I got a job almost immediately with this. And I'm not sure if I'm not even going to say, I'm not even going to dox him that way. I got a job immediately at a porno magazine. I'll just say that much. So I wrote basically articles making fun of the porno industry for 5 years. That became my gigantic book of sex. But I moved out of Portland because sooner or later I was going to go back to, someone was either going to kill me or an ex. I mean, I wrote a book called The Headache Factory, which I don't sell because I don't think it's one of my better works, but that details all the women who decided to use my, I mean, it was weird. It was an aphrodisiac for all these crazy Portland chicks, the fact that I went to prison for beating up a woman. But it's like, okay, I'm done with you. How many of them tried to get me arrested again for stuff I hadn't done was insane. Right. So moved back east, was still writing for the porno magazine long distance, but then I had to get a square job. I had a kid and I worked in a back decompression, like this glorified traction device. I was their graphics guy and did all the promotional materials for this medical company. And then I was laid off due to the Great Recession around 2010. And Gavin McInnes, who worked for Tacky's, he suggested that I write there, and I wrote there for 10 years. And that at first, because there's an early Curb Your Enthusiasm where Larry's trying to get Julia Louis-Dreyfus her own show on HBO. And she said, you know, I like HBO because you can say fuck.
Right. I remember that.
To me, it's like with Tacky's, it's like, all right, I'm going to try to write, and it's going to offend people, not purposely, but I focus on what people are uptight about because I don't understand why, without saying fuck. That'll be a challenge. But, you know, I did a whole episode of Beef Squad talking about why I fell out with Tacky's wonderful, brilliant, erudite daughter. But, you know, no reason to drag us, any of us, through that again. But yeah, 10 years of Tacky's. And doing freelance for others, I've done, I think, 10 or 11 books at this point, mm-hmm. but only two were originally written as books. Everything else is cobbled together. Like it's either an anthology or, you know, Whiteness, the Original Sin was just all these Tacky and other articles that I'd written about, you know, specifically whiteness or gender psychosis about transgender and homosexuality and uptight men and screaming hysterical rape panics and everything. And then the one of personal essays, The Bomb Inside My Brains. But it's all, I mean, I guess I'm double dipping because I get paid for what I write. But when you're a freelancer and you don't get health insurance and vacation, you're not technically an employee. You own the copyright. So,
right.
Yeah, but I guess I just spilled the beans on that. So when you're buying these books, you can find it all online for the most part. But
yeah, it changes the experience to read it on paper between covers. And if you want to give it as a gift, it's far better to give it in the form of a book rather than, here's some really great links. Here's a link tree for you. So folks, if you have questions for Jim, why don't we go to Entropy first and see if there's some questions at Jim. Go to entropystream.live/countercurrents if you want to send a question, comment, or donation. I'm just going to run through a few of them on here. Okay. Antaro has sent in a number of donations, $5, another $5. And a $5 Jim Goad karaoke request. It's the end of the world as we know it. Great Big C cover. If not, I'm going to be the Proclaimers. Pretty sure REM doesn't want anyone singing their version at all. And he sends $5 for that. But then he sends $100 and he says, Jim Goad karaoke, serious request. Go with the Flow by Queens of the Stone Age. Very topical, highly recommended. Are you familiar with that song at all?
Nah, but I'll do it. I mean, this is a fundraiser. That's the thing too. That's what I caution. I guess because we haven't really talked about this on here. Like I will do from now until the new year for $100. And if I think I can do it justice and handle it, I will do pretty much any song that you request, but I'm not going to learn Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, the libretto for that. I'm not going to do an entire side of Tales from Topographic Oceans for Yes. I already have suffered enough indignities by agreeing to do a Morrissey song, so I have my list. But So someone suggested White Wedding by Billy Idol. Okay, I'll do that one too because it has the word white in it.
Well, that's actually a great song. I think that would be very cool. I want to hear that. $100 and up, folks. If you want to go even higher, Jim, yeah, we'll do your karaoke requests.
I've also agreed to Waltzing Matilda, the Australian folk song or whatever.
Oh, that's great. What other ones have you agreed to?
I can't even. I mean, I'm so burnt at this point. There's about six or seven at this point. So my entire holiday season will be spent learning and performing these songs.
Well, we know that you can definitely do covers of Hungry Like the Wolf.
PJ Mavis Sorweeney. Yeah.
This is, folks, if you've never seen Jim do karaoke, just look up his parody of M. Davis Orini as a karaoke version of...
Somebody asked me to do Hungry Like the Wolf, and I mean, I always had this seething hatred for Duran Duran, but I negotiated. I'm like, can I do a parody of this? And I did something called Sneaky Like the Snake. That's how you'll find it. But Jim Goes Karaoke Cavalcade, you can find them all on YouTube. But... if you're unfamiliar with PJ Mavis Sorweeney, he was originally? I think he was like an anarchist, polysexual, hot rod builder, Canadian mounted police. He's one of these typical online guys. He went from libertarianism and then to men's pickup, the manosphere in some vague way. Then white identity for about 5 minutes, and now he's been a Catholic, a hardcore, nigh invincible, I think is what he said on Twitter, Catholic. But the funny thing about this guy, he's warped in a lot of ways. I don't think he's as malicious as his former partner, but he came to interview me about some Gamergate movie that he was doing with this other guy, Jordan Owen, and it was fascinating. Like, when he came into my apartment, it was almost like... you ever see like the waves of heat rising off the asphalt on a really, really hot day in the summer?
Yeah.
I was just kind of knocked over by these waves of gay because he's so like, I'm talking about, masculinity. And so if you're going to talk about masculinity, change the way you talk. But there was this 2-hour live stream where I was debating this obese, pathological liar, loser guy. And Orini posed as the moderator. He didn't moderate at all. He basically blocked me from listing links to things where the obese guy bragged about raping this woman and everything. But at a certain point, he says, I feel like I'm talking with the devil. I'm like, do you believe in demons, Davis? He's like, I believe in you because you're sneaky. And I said, you're sneaky? I'm like, what are you, Paul Lind? Like, come out, Davis. Like, no one cares, but like... you talk like you have, like my friend Hunter says, like you have a 50-foot cock in your mouth. Then I'm not sure there was a big falling out between him and the obese guy, and Orini lost his YouTube channel. Somehow I got blamed for it. I guess because he thought like that humiliating them. I was so guilty for humiliating them that I petitioned YouTube to take it down. But then when you tap into these extremely online people, you realize that reality, like it's a whole new wave of psychosis that I don't think existed before the online world. But yeah, I think Orini still believes I had something to do with him losing his precious YouTube channel, which pisses me off because, look, I'm a guy I've faced obscenity trials. I've been canceled in all sorts of ways. I'd never do that. And why would I want like this sterling testament to me owning these guys taken off? It's still there. It's a friendly conversation between Jim Goat and Matt Forney. And I think some guy named John Steele hosts that. And this started this whole thing because I'm sure you're familiar with that name, Matt Forney. Mm-hmm. He was, he was another one who tried to wriggle his adipose body into libertarianism and then men's rights or whatever, manosphere or pickup artistry. And for a little while, he was a rise up white men type of guy, right? Yeah, and then he became a trad cat for a while, but he tends to get laughed out of all these scenes he tries to leech onto. But the drama that's actually finally been concluded around that 2-hour live stream with Orini and the other guy revolved around former Countercurrents writer Ann Sturzinger. Now, this is such a Godian story because I knew Anne had known the Matt guy. And so I was going to debate the Matt guy over an article I wrote called In Defense of Degeneracy, which he took, like, he did a 90-minute live stream about I'm an idiot, I'm a coward. And I'm like, oh, God, me and my female friends have been making fun of this guy for 5 years. This is a fantastic opportunity to make fun of him to his face. And So I asked Anne, like, what's the deal? Like, and she said that he raped her and he bragged about it, but she never had the conscience to be able to go to the cops and say, yeah, lock this guy up, because she was too passed out drunk to remember. According to Anne, her boyfriend at the time and his friend walked in on it. And she says that Forney pulled up his pants, or as much as he could get his pants up, and ran out. But then he started, like, slandering her and calling her whatever, but this could only happen in Goatland. Like, 4 hours, 5 hours after I got all this intel, in the middle of the night, I get a text from her saying, I've just been raped. I'm like, are you kidding? She's like, no. And I'm scared to call the cops because I think the guy lives in my building. I'm like, call the cops. Like, he raped you. He's not playing nice as it is. And so she called the cops and they took her and, you know, they put her in the ambulance and took her and, you know, scraped her vagina for DNA. And so, like, she got back home, and a couple days later, I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this debate with this guy. If it should come to it, is it okay if I bring up this situation? Because my whole thing, the little trap that I was setting, is he's another one of these phony-ass moralists. Now he's posing as a trad Cath and traditional Christian. I want to see how he responds when he finds out someone he was once close with has been raped again, not by him this time. She's like, yeah, sure. So some point during the stream, and it's still available on YouTube, like, I said something like, well, here's what a girl like that knows you said about you. And I don't get a half sentence in. He's like, that's Anne Sturzinger, and she's a liar, and she's a lesbian. And I'm like, really, man? She was raped the other night. Ah, bullshit. Drag her on. Okay. So I text her. I'm like, he wants you on the show. Is that okay? She comes on the show. She's clearly a mess. Clearly, it's evident just looking at her. She's been traumatized very recently. He gets into this high school thing about, like, because according to Anne, he moved in to, like, right in her neighborhood in Chicago just to be with her. And no, he's arguing, no, she was stalking him. It was so juvenile. And I didn't even expect, as low as this guy goes and as pathetic as he is, over the course of the next few weeks, he starts doing all these podcasts about how she's lying, she's gaslighting, I'm a sucker for her, I'm her simp or whatever, and denied that she'd been raped. I never understood why. Because that same night that I was on Orini and Forney's thing, I went on the Weekly Sweat with Beardson Beardley, Prince Hubris, Sean McCaffrey, and Nicholas J. Fuentes. And it was Prince Hubris who insisted that Anne couldn't possibly have been raped. I'm like, why? Oh, because she's a woman. It's like, okay, but what you got to understand about a lot of these trad cats, they're so against white identity and against women. And it's crazy for me, the, like, philanderer and woman beater, to say, guys, you're going too far with the woman stuff. But they would automatically assume the black rapist was innocent and the white woman was lying for some reason. And so I bet Sean McCaffrey $50. I'm like, I know she was raped. Like, I coached her along as she was in the ambulance and everything. Nah, you're... And so for a couple months, I endured all these groiper types saying, you know, give it up, pay the $50. So this led to this legendary 7-hour live stream on Luke Ford. The reason I went on Luke Ford that night has been obscured, I guess, successfully by this deflection campaign. It's documented that Matt Forney and his idiot friend Edwin Oslin had been kept out of this Ann Coulter event in West Hollywood by David Cole. Like, David gave him a free ticket, but he wasn't going to give him free drinks. Edwin, some dumbass child of wealth, this was an indignity to him. I've got all the messages of Forney and Edwin planning to leave flyers throughout Los Angeles saying that this Nazi is going to be speaking in West LA, Queen Anne, Ann Coulter, and encouraging Antifa to smash the event. That's why I went on Luke Ford. Luke Ford is a head injury victim, according to his own words. He's a crypto Jew or a Bitcoin Jew. He's this Nordic guy who, I guess to piss his dad off, became a Jew and pretends he's Jewish. He says he didn't believe anything about this, or it wasn't a big deal that they tried to get Antifa to blow up or, you know, to sabotage an Ann Coulter event. What Forney and the other guys focused on was something I wrote in Shit Magnet about a sexual event when I was in my late teens, and just hammered on that and never shut up about it. But then but the ante was up that night. Prince Hubris, Sean McCaffrey, who was drummed out of the Air Force for his white nationalist inclinations or whatever, he bet me his mom's house that Ann wasn't raped. Like, okay, it's 2 months later. The rape kit should have come back at this point. Nah, this is Illinois. I think there's one crime lab in all of Illinois. It took 8.5 months. Yeah, the rape kit came back. She was raped. The black guy that they said couldn't have raped her, raped her. And finally, just 2 days ago, the guy was in jail for 3 years. They caught him a year later. He took a plea bargain for 25 years for this. So, Groypers, you lost. You're full of shit. I'm one of the few who's been saying that forever. You're going to fall much worse than Richard Spencer did, and I'll be there laughing the entire time.
Well, I remember one of these streams with you and Forney, and I think Ann was in it. And I thought, this is the most compelling. I'm not a live stream person, right? And I'm not a blood sports person. But that was the single most brutal destruction of a quote-unquote human being I've ever seen in a live stream event. If you talk about internet blood sports, that's just a metaphor in most cases.
That's what was so absurd about their insistence that I was so humiliated in this that I petitioned for YouTube to take it down. In truth, the mighty Orini, you can still look at this live stream. It's on some other guy's YouTube page, John Steele with an E on the end. Like, he's muting me. He's not letting me give links out. He blocked me on Twitter immediately thereafter. While I immediately advertised. I'm like, here, go look at this destruction of these people. Yeah. But they form this narrative that I'm just doxing them and everything else. And it's never been the case. I've never seen people more averse to truth or more pathologically into lying just to say, I mean, if you were Matt Forney, is that a face worth saving? There's no face. It's a horrible face. Keep your face sheathed. You have no dignity. There's nothing truthful about you. You have no talent. You're a joke wherever you fucking go. Just fade away quietly. Because wait till Anne's book comes out. Oh, boy. She's written a whole book about it because she tried to bite her lip. And I told her, it's like, look, it can be fatal to be too nice to people. You felt sorry for this loser. And this is what happened. He's just stalked and gaslit you and lied about you for years. But that's the way it works. But it was wonderful. But I think that's why they engineered 2 months later. Well, let's have 8 guys on one against him on Luke Ford and have them screaming at him the whole time so he can't get a word in and let that look like a victory. So fine. But the whole premise was, yeah, Forney did encourage Antifa, Edward Oslin, to get these radicals to wreck an Ann Coulter event. The truth of that hasn't changed, and the truth that Ann was raped hasn't changed either. I don't care what people think or say or if I'm popular. Truth is all I care about, so I win because I was correct.
Yeah, and these people are disgusting, and you had a bead on just how disgusting they were because you knew from the inside, you know, as a friend of the victim, what had happened, and you saw how they're willing to simply dismiss, lie, gaslight, spin.
Just for clout or scene status or just, yeah, you know, for whatever their dumb cause is. It's like, that's where I draw the line, I guess. Like, whatever the ideology is, if they get a fact wrong, I care more about the fact. I don't care about the ideology. So whatever that makes me, fine. Yeah. It makes me autistic, I guess.
It makes you principal, but truth is not in these people. They say things not because it's true, but because they want to make an effect, to make an impression on people. And usually that impression is to be an asshole. they like playing the villain. They like playing the asshole.
It's interesting because when someone first, and this would have been like 10 years ago, like, they're like, no, you don't understand what a troll is. I'm like, okay, what is a troll? It's like, they don't mean what they're saying. They're just doing it just to get the, you know, to get the laughs. And that didn't compute with me. It's like, well, God, everything I do is because I think it's important to set the record straight. But
right.
I mean, I can be an asshole if but I like to give people, for my own conscience's sake, I like to give people, like, take your first shot, because it's going to be the last shot you ever take. You know, but I don't go out of my way to look to fuck with people. But if they do, I will find a way to get even, and more than even. Because, well, I mean, I had to fight for myself. My parents were antagonists. I had to form this crustacean-like ego just to survive.
Yeah. Well, you got the last word. The last word is tonight, if you want to say more about it on future occasions. But the official last word on all this stuff with Forney and Fuentes and McCafferty and Sturzinger is now said. The guy has pled guilty. He's going to be spending more than 20 years in prison because of this rape. And these people wanted to dismiss it and deny it. Well, why? Because they've got issues with women. And they want to be big men on the internet. Big men in the small puddle of the internet.
And I said this at the conference, right, in Atlanta a couple months ago. It's such a weird thing because I made my bones as like the most misogynist guy in the world in the 90s. I'm the author of Let's Hear It for Violence Toward Women. I did a spoken word version of that. I was raised by nuns. My mom and my sister were just awful. And I've got this string of absolutely horrific experiences with, like, the girl I went to prison over. Like, you can hear her voice messages threatening to cut my head off, cut my nipples off. I know how absolutely rotten women can be. And even after going to prison, though, they still lined up by the dozen to call to you have sex with me. That's the difference between me and these guys.
Right.
They don't know a goddamn thing about women. Yeah, they kind of have this vague sense that women can be bad because they've been rejected by them their whole lives, but they don't know any of the good side. They're in these online all-male circle jerks calling everyone else who's not jerking off along with them fags, and they don't see the irony in this.
Yeah.
And they want to talk about demographics, but it's like, well, you're going to have to find at least one white woman to be nice to if this is your dream. But now you have these incels. They're making it like a virtue to be an incel. It's like, oh boy, once you get too old to get it up, you're going to be really pissed off at these people who preach this stuff to you, because sex is a lot of fun. I'm not sure who got in your ear to make like the anti-sex league, but it's pathological at this point.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, these people like Roosh, who, well, I'm a player, and, you know, bang the Ukraine. And it's, now he's this Orthodox rabbi. It's insane. But I mean, that's the thing I take pride in, is I haven't really changed one opinion in the last 30 years. I mean, and maybe some people say that's just stubbornness, but it's like, no, I'm really dubious about human nature, especially people who proclaim how good they are and spend all their time talking about how bad everyone else is. I've come to believe that Jews might be more responsible for things than I thought 30 years ago. I still think people are unequal and human nature is rotten, but nothing else has changed. But these people, oh, libertarian. No, this year I'm a men's rights guy. No, this year I'm white identity. No, now I'm an anti-Wignat Christian cat. Like, what's next? Like, I don't know, anal yoga. Like, what is the next big move for these people? Like, it's going to be something weird, but it just shows they change social identities like people change clothes.
Yeah. Yeah. Gadius has sent in another $10. Do you gents think the 90s was the last decade with its own unique culture? It seems that ever since the mid aughts, because of the internet, culture stagnated in nostalgia and recycled material is all we get now from the entertainment industry. That's an interesting question. Do you think there was a 90s culture, and are there decade cultures after that? And if not, why not?
Yikes. I mean, I think for the most part, 90s culture was pretty rotten too. I mean, grunge and black nationalist hip hop. What the hugest difference, and I've covered this in my last feature for Countercurrents, was back then, and I remember with my first podcast co-host, Keith E. Lee, who wound up killing himself, but he was in the Atlanta punk scene in the 90s, and he marveled, like, you could have Nazi skinheads hanging out with black reggae guys, and there'd be no problem. And people didn't care what you thought. It didn't make you a demon if you thought differently. There was this kind of open-mindedness. People could tell the difference between your belief system and your behavior. Now, I write about this in this last feature. After Gavin got squeezed out of Vice, and part of it, I think, had to do with publishing me, But Gavin would say things off the cuff. He told me once he went into a board meeting. They said, okay, here's our new ad guy. He's gay. And Gavin says, I'm like, oh, I love homos. But he got reprimanded and he got like, you know, some kind of. So once he got squeezed, I noticed that the Vice writers, if they mention anybody whose politics were perceived as even tepidly right-leaning, that person was an asshole. Strange to me, because to me, an asshole is like, okay, I'm going to go pee. Don't eat my French fries, and they'll eat your French fries. Like an asshole, it's by behavior, not beliefs. People were able to distinguish between the two. Now, I think social media was the biggest enabler of this, but if you think differently than the other side, you deserve to be killed. No one seems to see that that's really troubling, that we're at that point where we can't even see that someone who thinks differently is, you know, they're human. And I know that's a corny, especially coming from like a misanthrope like me, but if you listen to me, I'll insult people up and down. What you never hear me say is something like, well, that person's a piece of shit. He's complete scum. He deserves to die. I never get into that. I mean, sure, I have murder fantasies and everything, but I mean, they talk about objectively just because they think differently. These people need to be exterminated. That's where the cultures come. I mean, the 90s were much more open-minded. You know, I think these things are always a factor of the economy and the demographics and things, you know, invisible things we're not even aware of. But yeah, the world was a lot better back then than it is now. People are just hyper politicized. It's nauseating. And I lived through the 70s, and the 70s were a fun time. But you know, there were a lot of cults. There were the Hare Krishnas, the Moonies, the Simeonese Liberation Army. As the 2020s were rolling around, I'm like, this is going to be a lot like the 70s. I think I was partially right, but I think there are not a lot of cults too, left and right. And that's it. And you click up, and maybe this is a factor. Maybe people can rightly sense we're heading toward a collapse and revolutionary times. Pick your side, because the other side's going to pick you up. I understand that, but hasn't happened yet. Can we at least be cool to each other? And until it happens, I don't know. But it's kind of hilarious to see, because the world is measurably worse than it was back then. I don't blame the Zoomers, though. I could, if I was into astrology. Oh, you chose it, but the boomers didn't make the world back then. The Zoomers aren't making this world. We're all pretty much victims of circumstance from the very few who actually set policy and make decisions important enough to change like our living conditions. Nobody back then. I mean, just some asshole going to work like I did. I had no control. And, you know, I spoke as loudly as I could about the things that I thought were wrong. Didn't change anything. Messed my life up for the most part. So I don't know. But yeah, the world to me now is like objectively far worse. And yeah. I think it's almost entirely because we live, I mean, right now I'm talking to a glass lens. People mm-hmm. they're not in the same room anymore. And I don't think it's this parasocial environment that like didn't exist 100 years ago. I don't think the human brain's ready for it. And it's why people are so weird and sketchy these days.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I don't really have a bead on the culture of the 90s, I guess. I certainly have a sense of the culture of the 1980s and the feel of that time, because I was paying more attention, I think, to the popular culture then. By the time the 90s rolled around, I was ignoring a lot of that. I was exploring other things besides pop culture, put it that way. I had my nose in books, and I was listening to classical music, and I was tuned out. And so I was tuned out of the whole Clinton era, because I just found Bill and Hillary Clinton so loathsome. And I was tuned out of the pop culture then. So I would be hard-pressed to put my finger on the character of that time. It was funny. It was in the early 2000s that I discovered grunge. After Kurt Cobain was dead and all that, I discovered that whole music world. So I kind of missed the 90s, I guess. That was, maybe I didn't miss much, but I definitely missed the 90s.
What's fascinating to me, and I think this came about, like, because when we were doing Answer Me, I mean, Debbie was pushing 40 and I was in my early 30s. So we were old for zinesters. But I noticed that the ones who were like in their late teens and early 20s, they were what I call pop culture inbreds. they were so raised on movies and music and TV shows, they had no literary tradition. They couldn't think analytically to save their lives. And it's like, well, yeah, well, your mom got beaten up. Yeah, that reminds me of the scene in Death Wish where, and you, this is all people do these days. They actually, when they see something that really happens, their only reference is something that was fake.
Yeah.
I think that's been enhanced and made and augmented, made much worse by the fact that we live virtual lives now, that hardly anything's real. The thing I always remember, like in my brick row home neighborhood when I was a kid, I could tell you the first and last names of everybody who lived on both sides of the block. Right now, I know there's a Mike across the street. That's all I know. It's weird because we're more connected, but like way more atomized. There's no such thing as local communities anymore. It's just this horrific, nightmarish global community, you know. But like I said, I don't think the human brain's ready for it. One day they'll figure out what went wrong, hopefully, and try to fix it. But I don't see it happening anytime soon.
I have a question here from Sutton. And it's directed specifically to Jim. Jim, what do you do to cultivate your creativity? You're a very creative guy. So do you have certain routines that you use to cultivate your creativity? Any herbal teas? Any kind of, I'm just spitballing here. This could get really new agey and funny.
Yeah. I mean, thank you for thinking I'm creative. The only intoxicant I ever use anymore is Delta 8 marijuana through gummies. That's it. It's legal here in Georgia. I don't drink. I don't smoke anything. I mean, I haven't had a drink since Ronald Reagan's first term. Don't do any other kind of drugs. Don't even do caffeine. Because I've had so many health scares, I try to stay healthy for spite. I mean, the things that I think are really the best are the things that I'm infuriated about and can't sleep until I get it out. Mm-hmm. And, if I write things on assignment, it's a lot harder to write. The thing now, especially with writing about politics and race so much, you don't want to repeat yourself, but it's kind of impossible. So that's the challenge for me now. It's like, okay, we know they're lying about this. Oh, and if a white guy had done this, but I'm trying to look for different angles, and it's difficult. But I remember asking Russ Meyer, the guy who did all the exploitation movies with the girls with the big boobs in the 60s and 70s. And he just said, he's like, I make the type of movies I would like to watch. So I choose the topics and write it in a way that if I had seen it and didn't know it was me, I'd enjoy it. If that makes any sense. Creativity is in the eye of the beholder. I'm not sure it's flattering, but I'm not sure what to say about that. But like to come at things from a different angle and not repeat myself, although it's almost impossible.
So what kind of schedule do you have or routine do you have?
Man. It's crazy. Mrs. Goad, who's just, I can't say or think a bad thing about her. We've been together 4 years and I mean, not a single argument, if you know anything about my history with women, it's amazing, but she works in the medical industry. She works 3 or 4 days a week, like 16 hour shifts. And that requires her to get up at 2 a.m. 3 or 4 days a week and then sleep in the other days. So that, and I'm the lightest sleeper in the world. So basically I stay awake and work until I can't take it anymore and fall asleep. And so there's no real schedule, but I write 2 articles for Countercurrents. I do a 2-hour show for Censored. I publish my own books, which at this point is still the biggest moneymaker for me. And I still do freelance work. I still get health insurance through another website, which the guy is, he's a liberal and he's such a decent guy that I'm not going to get him in trouble by even mentioning the website, but I do editorial stuff for them behind the scenes, but it's constant. There's never anything the thing that sucks about being a writer is you're never done. It's not like you just, I've rebuilt the transmission. Now I have a weekend. It was June of 2010 that I wrote my first article for Tacky's Mag. It was about that really dumb, his name was Alvin Green. He was a Senate candidate from South Carolina, like amazing, like dumber than Herschel Walker, just stupendously dumb. But I was working a full-time weekly job And then I took on writing weekends for Tacky's. So since June of 2010, it's been 7 day weeks. And when you're a convict and a brain tumor survivor and a cancer survivor, and probably were born PTSD, you'd like to take a break sooner or later, but we live in such a sketchy economy. Plus, I've got a son to take care of. I'll still keep doing as much work as I can get away without, you know, dying from it until, you know, the circumstances force me to take some time off, I guess. But it's, yeah, there's no, I don't throw salt over my shoulder. There's no rituals. It's like, what do I got to write about now? Okay. Snuff films. Okay, great. And get it done. But try to keep it interesting and come at it from a different angle with the weekly news roundup and with each feature. Sometimes I think they're discomfortingly personal for the readers and they're not, you know, on message enough, but I do what I can.
I'm just wondering if there are more questions, comments, or donations. Ah, I've got a couple of questions from Eric here. So I think these are good questions. Jim, do you know how to dance? Do you enjoy dancing? We know you sing, right? Do you do a song and dance? Do you like to go dancing?
Well, I've never gone dancing, but I remember in eighth grade at Holy Cross Elementary School in the auditorium, dancing to Ballroom Blitz by The Sweet, I won the bump contest with Linda McNamara. And that's one of my proudest achievements. I like to think that I have rhythm, but, you know, as far as, the thing about me is I'm not very coordinated and I'm extremely inflexible. So I'm not sure how good a dancer that I am. I took martial arts classes, and the strengths, at least according to everyone else in the dojo, was that I'm impervious to pain and really, really strong. But the weaknesses are I'm not coordinated. And I'm not flexible. So I just, you know, in case you ever like want to get into a back alley fight with me, I've just revealed my strengths and weaknesses.
So what martial arts did you study?
It's so corny. And it's not because I wanted to become a ninja. It's the ninjutsu dojo in Stone Mountain was the closest to where I lived. And this Vietnam vet taught it. Uh-huh. I've actually learned a lot of things because I'm just this dumb Philly brawler. I just come at you with my left hook and hope for the best. But like, oh, you want to not get hit? Okay. Go like that, like simple things and things about leverage and balance and how to do joint locks. And I could, you know, break your arm pretty easily, stuff like that. The thing that was really hard for me was yoga because I'm like a surfboard. I'm not flexible at all. And so every fat woman in the class was better at yoga than I was.
Interesting. So do you play any musical instruments? This is another question from Eric.
No, I'm left-handed and musical instruments are prejudiced against me.
Okay. I want to answer these questions. Do I know how to sing and do I enjoy singing? No, I'm not good at singing. Do I know how to dance? No. Do I play any musical instruments? Piano and clarinet are things that I studied, and I would love to go back to playing the piano again, but I'm just so damn busy and I just haven't done it. I should just get an electric keyboard because those are easy to, you can plug headphones into them so you're not disturbing the neighbors. They're easy to move around. You don't have to hire special movers to move the piano. They're easy to pack up. But I just don't have the time, and maybe I just need to make the time for that. Do I know any martial arts? No. Just how to fire a gun. And that's a martial art. I know how to use a gun. And that's really the best martial art, honestly. Short of, you know, artillery and nuclear missiles and guiding in drones, just using a gun. And am I an early bird or a night owl? I used to be a huge night owl. I am now pretty much, I wouldn't say I'm an early bird, but I get up in the mornings and I try and get a lot of work done in the mornings. Usually what I do is work when I'm not distracted. And I used to find that working at night was proof against distraction. And then I think it was around 2016, 2017, I just started finding that working in the morning was better for avoiding distractions. And one of the things that you just have to do is just discipline yourself, right? Because most distractions are internal distractions. And that includes self-imposed things like the internet. and your phone, things like that. You can simply shut those things out of your life for a while and block off time to do creative stuff. And I just find that it's easier for me to do that in the morning because fewer people are trying to get a hold of me. And so I don't have calls to respond to and things like that if I use mornings as my creative time. Whereas if I work in the afternoon on creative things or I work in the evening, there's just more things are missing out on. So yeah, I'm more of a morning person when it comes to work, especially. So I have to get up in the morning to work, but I try and spend a couple hours a day as detached from external interruptions as I can.
With the singing, I never set out to be a singer, but mid-90s, Boyd Rice got control over some subsidiary of World Serpent Distribution in England, and he had some sub-label all to himself, so he offered all his friends, like, do an album. And I forget, I mean, Sean Partridge did one, other people, but I was into all this trucker music from the 60s because it was like white hip-hop. It's all these burly macho guys with really deep voices trying to like sing lower than the other guys about how their truck's bigger and goes faster. It was just all this dick sizing. I thought it was hilarious. So I'm like, all right, I'll do an album of trucker songs. And it was all covers. And it wasn't to say that, you know, it was basically just to point people toward the originals by Dave Dudley and Red Sovine and Dick Curlis. But Hank Williams III, who was a fan of Answer Me, heard the album. He's like, go on tour with me. I'm like, all right. It was like this George Plimpton thing. It's like, I'm not a singer. I don't want to be a singer. Musicians are the most fucked up creative types there are, maybe this side of comedians. But for the challenge, it's like George Plimpton playing four downs with the Detroit Lions. He's some Yale graduate. It's like, all right, I'm a country singer. And I went on tour singing country music for a summer in 2007, opening up for Hank Williams III. The accomplishment, I guess, is nobody knew who the hell we were. We practiced for 3 days and we never got booed. So I guess that's okay. But part of it too is like, I can carry a tune and being this hate mongering, Nazi woman beating, they're not supposed to be able to just sing. So I just kind of do it to confuse people and to raise funds for Countercurrents. Typically I'll do the $50 karaoke just for money and for laughs, but you know, this is fundraising season, so that's why. But yeah, get those requests in. I'm not even sure. I'm going to just start recording the ones where I can get confirmed payments and take it from there.
So Marianne has written in and she wants to know, who are your favorite country artists?
Oh, Lord.
Because she knows you like country music. So yeah. Who are your favorite country artists? And I guess we can ask, who are your favorite rock artists too? That's an interesting question.
As far as country, and I was surprised to arrive at this because I do on my show Hardballs, I've got a segment called Musical Justice because I'm not for social justice, but I tend to support artists especially a phase of an artist's career that's unfairly maligned or ignored. I think the best country music that was ever done was the 60s stuff by Waylon Jennings. Not any of the stuff you know about Waylon Jennings when he got a beard. He got a beard and grew his hair to look like a hippie because he bedded Pamela DeBar, the rock groupie. And he's like, why do you like all these young guys with the long hair? They look like fags. And she's like, no, the girls like that. He's like, the girls like that. So Waylon became a hippie. But it's just this schlocky, just a good old, but the stuff in the 60s is like Johnny Cash with like this mournful, eternal quality to it. So I'd go with Waylon Jennings. I think George Jones had the best voice as far as the little subgenre of country that never disappoints me is the trucking stuff by Dave Dudley and Red Sovine. It's just this exaggerated machismo. I can't listen to anything like 70 or after. I think it's the production, the Nashville sound of the 60s. It's a time when, you know, just American working class families, they had people speaking for them and they kind of had hope and things were getting better before the 70s came along and everything started falling apart again. But to me, I think it was also because I remember my dad, he had Johnny Cash live at Folsom Prison and he had the 45 Battle of New Orleans by Johnny Horton. And I think it was a way because we clearly did not get along, but I think I connected with him in a way by just getting into that music. There's something hypnotic about the country of the 60s is my favorite stuff. As far as rock, favorite all-time band is Slade. because they were so dumb, but huge. I mean, just so powerful. Like they, I think they were recorded as the loudest band for a while in the Guinness books. There were riots wherever they perform in England. They sold more records in England than any other band of the 70s, but never made it here. Robert Plant was considered for lead singer of Slade, but they chose his roadie, Noddy Holder, instead. When Bon Scott died, the singer of AC/DC, they asked Noddy Holder, it's like, sing for us. And he said, no, I'm too loyal to Slade. So they hired that guy who sounds like he's popping a hemorrhoid. I can't listen to any AC/DC after Bon Scott died. Although I think Back in Black's like the biggest selling studio album next to Thriller of all time. Can't stand it. But there was just something so raw, working class, tough about Slade. And just, you're not going to rock music for, you know, philosophy. Second favorite band is The Sweet. Same genre, the British glam of the early 70s. Punk rock kind of took that and took all the groove and all the fun, all the sexiness out of it. Really don't like punk rock that much. But otherwise, I think my favorite two artists of all time are from the 50s, white guy Eddie Cochran and Little Richard, which is heretical, I know, this homosexual, black homosexual from Georgia. But if you've ever worked out to music, try working out to She's Got It or Keep a Knockin' by Little Richard. You can't keep up. He's got way too much energy.
That's interesting. What about female country singers? Any favorite female country singers?
God, I mean, as far as rockabilly, because rockabilly is just basically fast country. Yeah. Wanda Jackson, the one you could fry an egg on her G-spot. Tammy Wynette. God, I remember hearing about Loretta Lynn, like, because Loretta Lynn was riding. She was the queen for a while, and she heard Tammy Wynette's first single, Apartment Number 9, which is one of the most chilling songs about loneliness. She's been dumped by this guy, but, you know, if you want to come back and find me, you'll just, you know, just follow the stairway to Apartment Number 9. Loretta Lynn said when she heard that first line, she's like, oh, boy, I've got competition. But as far, I think Loretta Lynn was the queen of country music, and she just had this PMS quality, this catty, and all these like catfight songs like Fist City, I'll lift you by the hair of the head and I'll lift you off of the ground, like if you come near my man. And I mean, Dolly Parton's a very talented songwriter.
Her songs are beautiful. I think Down from Dover is just a heartbreakingly beautiful song.
Is that a Dolly Parton song? I know that
you wrote that.
Like Lee Hazelwood and Nancy Sinatra did it. That's the version I know. But yeah. And it's what's funny too. So they did. I don't know how you measure this, but they did. Country fans are the most misogynist. Like, I'd like to see how they arrive at this. But
well, rap is in the running, definitely. I would imagine. So
to be fair to country though, they always had, you know, female artists who were selling millions and
yeah.
Back, I mean, Charlie Pride, black singer, he won Country Music Artist of the Year for like 73 and 74, when like the only black rocker was Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
It's where they were strangely more progressive than rock music for a while there. It's weird, too. I don't think kids these days treat music like a religion like people in my generation did. It was extremely important, like what music you listen to for whatever reason. I don't know. I'm not sure why it was important, but it seemed to dominate people's lives much more back then.
Did you ever hear Tammy Wynette doing this bizarre, I don't even know what you'd call it, sort of this world pop rap funk mashup from the KLS is called Justified and Ancient.
No.
And it is absolutely hilarious because, well, it's incredibly catchy and weird. And then you have Tammy Wynette singing on it. And the video is quite a scream. Find the Justified and Ancient video by the KLS. And she had to have thought that this was just a complete joke. And yet the little bit of singing she does on it, it's just achingly sincere and heartfelt. And to me, that really shows what an amazing artist she was, because she can sell this goofy stuff and yeah. still get your heart. So yeah, I think she was an amazing artist. Great voice.
if pressed to name my favorite movie, I would say it's probably Five Easy Pieces from 1970 with Jack Nicholson and Karen Black. But Tammy Wynette's got at least three songs on that. Stand By Your Man, D-I-V-O-R-C-E, and When There's a Fire in Your Heart. Yeah, but actually, The Girl I Went to Prison Over, I once made them, I mentioned this in Shit Magnet, I once made the mistake of saying that I thought Tammy Wynette was attractive. And whenever a Tammy Wynette song would come on the local country, she would get livid at me. But chicks, you know.
Well, we just got a karaoke request. The $100 came in. It is for the I-95 song by August Campbell. So I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah.
Look into that.
I'll have to, apparently.
Yeah. I'll send the information along to you, but it's got to be a trucker song. So the comment is, hail Greg, hail Jim. $100 for the I-95 song by August Campbell. It's right up your attitude alley. Okay. Well, this is very cool. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Oh, and Frank Rizzo, curious about Dr. Johnson's favorite pop music artists. Well, honestly, there are a whole lot of them, but it sort of peters out around the late 80s. I kind of lost track. There are a few artists that I sort of followed for a long, long time and still follow today, and a few people that I discovered anew in the 90s or the early 2000s. But most of it's just stuff that I heard when I was a kid, and it imprinted me. I like the Beatles. I like the Rolling Stones. I like the Doors. I like Led Zeppelin a lot. I like David Bowie tremendously, although he had his ups and downs. There's no question about it.
I like everything he did with Mick Ronson and nothing he didn't do with Mick Ronson.
The early period with, you know, Hunky Dory, Ziggy Stardust.
Man Who Sold the World.
Man Who Sold the World. Yeah. I love that period up to and including Diamond Dogs. I think Diamond Dogs is an absolute masterpiece. Then he sort of lost it for a while. I thought Young Americans was a really fake and gross album, honestly. And it was his American funk period. And I didn't like it. Then he did Station to Station, which I thought was kind of amazing. Then he had his Berlin period, which lasted for a while. And then the 80s came along, and a lot of people thought he really sucked in the 80s. But 90s Bowie, from around 1992 to 2000, I think it's just amazing stuff. He did some of his best albums then, and some of his live stuff from that period is absolutely amazing. I like Queen. I'm trying to think of some other people that I really get into pop music. Yeah, those are definitely a few.
I like a lot of the garage bands of the 60s, like the Standells and Count Five and stuff like that. Because these are American bands who heard the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and decided to take a go at it. And they weren't as good, but there was like twice the passion.
Mm-hmm. One of my favorite artists of all time is Zappa. I'm a huge Zappa fanatic. I listen to him all the time. And so, yeah, he's definitely one of the towering.
I love the first three Mothers albums, but that's where it ends. Like after that, I'd rather hear him talk.
Well, he was hilarious to listen to talk to. That's definitely true. I think Freak Out, his very first album, is one of the greatest things he ever did.
I think that's his best, yeah.
Yeah. I think the early 70s Mothers with George Duke and Napoleon Murphy Brock and that particular group of musicians was an amazing period too. One Size Fits All is one of his absolute great albums. That was from 1975. So anyway, I think he kept doing great music right up until he died. But he was certainly one of the most versatile artists of all time. He did electronic music. He did classical, symphonic music, chamber music, stuff like that. And he also did rock and big band music too. A couple of his big band albums from the early 70s, Waka Jawaka and the Grand Wazoo, are just absolutely amazing. And I have bought a Christmas present for myself because they're bringing out this box set of four CDs and a Blu-ray of those two albums, plus all the associated session cuts and outtakes and stuff like that. And I'm absolutely looking forward to that. That should be coming just before Christmas. So yeah, those are a few. Thank you very much. And Frank Rizzo, I appreciate that.
I love that name. And you get the Frank Rizzo reference, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Not enough people know who Frank Rizzo was.
Tell us a bit about Frank Rizzo and why you admire the man.
Whenever I bring the name up, people think of the Jerky Boys because that's what one of the characters was. But Frank Rizzo was the last great, gigantic, fat, totalitarian, fascist mayor, big city mayor in American history. He was the police commissioner of Philly during the 60s. There's a famous picture of him with a tuxedo and his nightstick sticking out. He was brutal. I mean, blacks hated him, but in the same token, in the 60s, there were no riots in Philly once Rizzo was commissioner. He would go in, he'd send his boys up into North Philly. It's like, okay, this is where the Black Panthers are hanging out. Drag them all out of the streets, strip them naked, humiliate them in front of the entire neighborhood. And he was known as a headcracker. But the city was pretty safe. And Frank Rizzo is the guy who said, a conservative is a liberal who was mugged the night before. He also said, the streets of Philadelphia are safe. It's the people who make them unsafe, which is kind of dumb, but it's true.
The idea that they always talk about the streets. It's usually liberals making excuses. You got to get them off the streets because it's the streets that make them commit those
dangerous crimes. Sidewalks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What else did he do? There were some anarchists. There was an anarchist bookstore called The Wooden Shoe in downtown Philly. He was running for re-election and they were giving him some static. And he said, you know, by the time I'm done with them, I'm going to make Attila the Hun look like a faggot, is what Frank Rizzo said. He also, I mean, he was hated by all the right people and loved by all the right people. But they recently in Philly, I mean, they had a Frank Rizzo statue. They had a Frank Rizzo mural, all defaced because he was a racist. But he was fantastic. And look up Frank Rizzo Lush, LUSH. There's this great footage. It was after he left the mayor's office. He's walking his dog somewhere in his neighborhood. A reporter comes up to talk to him. He's like, you're a lush. You're a creep. You're a crumb bum. I want to fight you. You think you're a man? You, the whole camp, we'll go over there. I'll fight you all. Get out of here. You're a lush. You're the second tell a lush. And it's like, we need a mayor like that again. He was like Trump, like much more unvarnished than Trump was.
Yeah. No, that is the beautiful face of American populism. And Frank Rizzo was the great man. Thomas Dubin writes in, what about the Steve Miller Band? Oh, yeah, definitely. The 70s, a lot of people say the 70s was a bad time. I think some of the greatest music ever done in popular music was in the 70s.
Jet Airliner or Rockin' Me are some of the finest, most hummable rock music songs ever made. Steve Miller is one of those guys. I've seen his face 1,000 times. I still couldn't tell you what Steve Miller looks like. I mean, as generic as the name Steve Miller is, that's as generic as his face is. But yeah, I like Steve Miller.
He's got a wonderfully warm voice and just great melodies, wonderful melodies. Yeah.
I saw him open for Fleetwood Mac at JFK Stadium in 1978, 90,000 seats.
Fly Like an Eagle and that whole period was just fantastic. Early 70s, Paul McCartney and Wings, Band on the Run. That's an amazing album. There was a lot of great popular music done.
I hate Paul McCartney, but I like the song Jet by Wings. Well,
that is a great song. And of course, one of the great albums of all time, I think, is Rumors from 1977 with Fleetwood Mac. Absolutely brilliant. The first Cars album and their best was in the 1970s. So it was a very good.
Since you mentioned the Cars, I'll use that as a stepping stone. But as far as like CBGB, the punk scene, the only band I think that still sounds ahead of its time is Suicide. Two dirty Jews from New York. One guy on instrument and one guy screaming. But they made music that was actually new music and still sounds new like 50 years later.
I'm really not familiar with them.
Oh, Lord. Look up Frankie Teardrop by Suicide. It's on YouTube. It's about 10 minutes. Bruce Springsteen was, for some reason, a fan of this song. And it's just, it's the most elemental, like Wurlitzer organ beatbox and just two droning notes. And it's Alan Vega, who I always thought was Puerto Rican. He looks Puerto Rican in the name Vega, but his real name was like Shlomo Abramowitz or something. But it's the story of Frankie Teardrop, 20-year-old Frank. He's married. He's got a kid, and he's working in a factory. He's working from 7 to 5, you know. But Frankie can't make it. Things are just too hard. He can't make enough money. He can't buy enough food. He's getting evicted. What does Frankie do? He picks up a gun, blows away his 6-month-old kid in the crib, shoots his wife, shoots himself. But it's the screams. Like, I first heard this, it was 1979, New Year's Eve, going into 1980. Me and a friend did some acid, went to a midnight mass just to see what mass would seem like on acid. Came back to my parents' house. We're in the kitchen at 3 a.m. trying to keep it down. There's this little transistor radio, and the DJ at Drexel University saying, this is the song the Philly punks voted to bring in the 1980s, Frankie Teardrop by Suicide. And it's kind of oddly seductive because it's just this two notes and this drone and there's this whiny guy's voice. So my ears, and on acid, I'm right up against, then when Frankie kills himself, this the most ungodly scream you've ever heard in your life. Then Frankie goes down to hell and is tortured again. But it's, I mean, what the Velvet Underground tried to conjure about just the sickness and the decay and despair of New York, Suicide did it better. And Lester Bangs said as much.
Well, that's really interesting. I'm totally unfamiliar with them. One thing I did want to ask you about was Adam Parfrey and Feral House, because again, when I first bumped into your work, it was at the same time I discovered Adam Parfrey. I discovered Feral House Publishing. I discovered the Apocalypse Culture anthology, the first one. I think the second one was just about to come out. And it was fascinating to read this because, again, before the internet, how did you find a lot of this alternative culture? Well, you had to find zines, you had to find alternative publishers, sort of niche publishers. You had to find bookstores that would put them on the shelf so you could bump into them. You just didn't have the ability to sit down and do web searches and find all of this obscure stuff. And I honestly think that for me, Answer Me and Feral House were two of the central 90s phenomena where alternative thinking, especially heretical thinking about race and such topics, let's just say realist thinking that basically was being crushed by political correctness even then, could be found. Heretical realist ideas about race and sex and just politics and humanity, they could be found there. And you knew Parfrey pretty well. I knew him near the end of his life, maybe in the last 6 years of his life, 6 or 7 years. I guess the first time I met him was in 2001. And so what are your thoughts about him and his contributions? Right.
I mean, as far as where people had to go to find this stuff, two of the best sources were Loompanics Unlimited, Loompanics, from Port Townsend, Washington. They kind of had a catalog of extreme stuff, especially like the sort of militia, anti-government, white-leaning stuff you couldn't find anywhere back then. And Amok Press, AMOK, which Parfrey was originally a member of, but the night I met Nick Bugis, I asked about Parfrey, and he said, yeah, well, he was too balls for the wall for Amok. Adam left Amok and started Feral House, but the Amok Fourth Dispatch especially was this wonderfully designed, beautifully designed catalog of all these extreme books you could not get anywhere else but order through Amok. The night I met Adam, it was over at Nick's place. I went over there, and Adam had this new kind of newfangled video camera that he could conceal, and he was bragging that he had just videotaped Irv Rubin of the Jewish Defense League eating spaghetti at Musso Frank's in Hollywood. And he had the camera right under, I mean, in Irv Rubin's big head, it looked like it was carved out of chopped liver, this Frankensteinian head. But he had it underneath as he's munching spaghetti. It looked like a Tyrannosaurus Rex, like eating eucalyptus leaves or something. But I remember being warned about Adam when I worked at the LA Reader. Someone said he's a fascist. And I got there and I said, well, people tell me you're a fascist. And he just winked. He said, as long as they're talking. And Adam was a brilliant guy. I think he was a better writer than a publisher because, I mean, especially Feral House these days, my God, like try going to feralhouse.com. There's this pop-up about, you know, Roe v. Wade is in jeopardy and pregnancy-capable people. Or they even said pregnancy-capable people, not women. Like everything that Adam would have hated. Yeah. The problem was, I mean, over the years, three notorious figures, Peter Sotos, Nick Bugis, and Adam Parfrey, I introduced them each to about 24 people. Across the board, everyone loved Nick. Everyone loved Peter Sotos. Everyone thought Adam was kind of a passive-aggressive, carping, bitchy kind of guy. We didn't end on a good note either. And I'm sure it wasn't fun for him to take my calls from prison or any of that. But I think we talked about this a couple years ago. He had a head injury in the early 90s that put him through the front windshield of his truck, which left him with water on the brain. And he had this really strange breakdown 96 on July 4th. And he was like in a paper robe in a mental hospital for a while. So there were neurological problems. But toward the end of his life, he started becoming this typical Trump derangement syndrome person screaming about, there was something about there were floods in Texas and Adam's on Facebook saying, well, let them drown because they're against socialism. And
yeah,
it was weird because like sometimes people will change their beliefs, but this was a different personality. Adam, the previous Adam would have seen that Adam and say, who's this humorless asshole? Because Adam had a wicked, great sense of humor. The best thing he ever did was, I'm pretty sure I talked about this before too, and I fell for it because I didn't know who he was, but there was a cover story in the late 80s in the LA Weekly about the Blue Boys. And it's, you see these two guys in umpire outfits. They've got the chest protector and the umpire mask. And the lead story, the cover story in the LA Weekly was about this gang of gay bashers called the Blue Boys that would terrorize West Hollywood on weekends. And I believed it was real. And they got these letters. Yes, I know someone who was, put in the hospital by the Blue Boys. And I remember my female editor at the LA Reader's like, we got to do a story about these Blue Boys too. And when I met Adam, he's like, well, those two guys on the front cover, those were me and Larry Wessel. Like, it was just a joke because I was preying on their sensibilities. It's like, but that Adam was gone. And I think it was neurological.
Yeah. I do think we talked about this.
Yeah.
When I first met him, it was in 2001. It was at the Seattle Esoteric Book Conference. And I was with Charlie Kraft there. And we spent a lot of time talking with Adam. And what a delightful person. I found him absolutely interesting. His father, Woodrow Parfrey Jr., was this character actor. And I amused him by knowing some of his father's parts. And he wanted to stay in touch. We were Facebook friends at that point. He was interested in Countercurrents, which was just off the ground like a year and a half before. And he gave me good advice about publishing stuff. I just found him to be warm and funny and utterly irreverent and a great pal, for Charles Kraft. And whenever he would come through Seattle, he'd sleep on Charlie's sofa. And there were a number of times when I was living in Seattle that I saw him near the end, and his personality had just changed completely. I saw this Trump derangement syndrome stuff on Facebook. It was bad. It was bad. And one of my friends in Seattle, Matt, coined a kind of wicked term, because not only did he become humorless and deranged and leftist, he also became increasingly Jewish. And his mother was Jewish. His father was, Anglo. His mother was a Jewish communist. And I'm sure she had a lot to answer for, which explained why he was such a fascist for a while. But he started getting really rather Jewish and kind of neocon-y Jewish. And Matt coined the term zoological clock. The clock was ticking.
Fantastic. But the thing that stands out, I remember him telling me, because people would say, well, why are you hanging around with all these Nazis, Nick Bugis and Boyd Rice? He told me a couple things. He said, number one, he heard the way his family talked about the Goyim. So every time Jews talked about racism, he thought they were full of shit.
Yeah.
He also told me, and I mean, I never said this when he was alive, but, and he can't defend himself, but I'd have no reason to make this up. He said his biggest inspiration, like to go balls to the wall, as Nick said, was Tom Metzger. He said Tom just didn't care. Tom believed what he believed and he didn't care what people thought. And that was a creative inspiration to Adam. But something changed. And then, David Cole, like he wasn't invited to Adam's funeral because they were against Holocaust denial. And Yeah, you go to Ferrell House now, everything new they're coming out with is, you know, busting balls, you know, women's tennis, like, and yeah, it's all this anti-male, anti, it's like the stuff that Adam would have blanched at in the 80s and 90s, which is
well sad. He published David Cole's book Republican Party Animal. So yeah. I saw a launch for that at the IHR in Southern California, and Adam was supposed to show up at that, and he didn't show, which was kind of a strange thing. He was in town. He came all the way down from Port Townsend, Washington, but he didn't show up at the IHR at the last minute for some reason. Aaron has written in with $20. Thank you. Jim, what is your first choice of the following bands to do a cover song? ZZ Top, Black Sabbath, Steely Dan, or AC/DC, preferably Bon Scott era?
Good Lord. I did NIB by Black Sabbath a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And oh God, I mean, I'd probably destroy my voice with AC/DC, like what's left of it. So I maybe some other Black Sabbath song. Because when I was 12, WFIL AM 560 in Philadelphia, they had some contest. And I called in first, answered right. I got this four-album set called Superstars of the 70s. Mm-hmm. And there was Rod Stewart, Faces, everybody was big, you know, and all these folk singers. But Paranoid by Black Sabbath was on there. I like that song so much. I wrote the lyrics down, showed them to my mom. She wanted to have me committed. She thought I had written them. So probably Ozzy's more in my range than, Bon Scott, that's a little too high. I've got a naturally kind of deeper voice, and hitting some of those high notes is brutal.
I have to say that I really did love AC/DC, Bon Scott era, specifically the Highway to Hell album. That's like my...
Oh, Dirty Deeds, High Volt, those are all great albums. That's
amazing stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
And I never really got into the later incarnation of them either, so I...
But none of it's nearly as good as Slade. Slade was like the template for AC/DC. Like, Get Down and Get With It by AC. It's Slade, my favorite band, doing a Little Richard song, my favorite musical artist. And they blow the roof off, just so powerful.
Well, folks, we have crossed the 75% barrier in the course of today's stream. We have now raised $225,927.48. So we're less than $75 away from $226,000. That's great. By this time last year, we were far behind that. And last year we raised, I think, a total of $219,000. So we've already blown past what we did last year. And we're a little under $100 away from that nice round 226,000 figure. So I really appreciate this. A number of donations have come in for Jim's cover song. So this is great. And I'm just going to check and see if we have any more questions or comments in the chat here. The question mentioning Steely Dan, all of their great work was in the 1970s, frankly. You know, another group that did all of their really great creative work in the 70s was the Eagles. I respect them. I think they were great, great musicians, interesting songwriters, great artists.
You know, but I mean, I'm not a fan of, and I'm going to be pedantic here. You know what bugs me the most? There's no "the," it's just Eagles.
Just
group of Eagles.
Yeah.
But I think they've got two of the three biggest selling albums of all time. I think Hotel California and their greatest hits are like up there, like insane. Yeah. I think they're the biggest selling American act of all time.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
I think Hotel California is filled with amazing music. I think it deserves to be that big. It's quite remarkable. Gadius has written in with another $10. Thank you very much. I know Jim said he can't do another Answer Me, but does he think he could bring back Chocolate Impulse, like a blog on Substack, perhaps?
I don't think I can. There's some reason I can't go on Substack. I think because they pay through Venmo and PayPal deplatform me with no explanation, so I can't even do a Substack. But I mean, Chocolate Impulse, and it's that zine that was ostensibly done by interracial lesbians who hated me and Debbie. And I was just aping what the progressive mindset was back then. And they all bought it because if you know anything about satire, it's the objects of, if it's done right, the objects mistake it for the real thing.
Oh, absolutely. These people take themselves so damn seriously. even when they pretend to be the ones who are funny and creative and able to think outside the box, et cetera, they take themselves so seriously. It's easy to pull the wool over their eyes. So folks, we have been going at this for 2 hours. So let's wrap up. Thank you so much, Jim. This has been really, really enjoyable. Folks, get the new Answer Me. If you haven't read Answer Me, if you haven't seen it, it's a cultural landmark of the 1990s, pioneering zine work. And it's been given its definitive form now, colorized, glossy, hardcover, cheap newsprint.
The Nick Bugis cover with, we got another Black Lives Matter there. We've got the announcer from KSHR. Oh, the humanity. Someone asked me if they thought that was supposed to be Colin Flaherty on the left there. It's like, no, that's just a generic Jewish announcer right there.
Well, that's great. So, folks, we will be back next week, Christmas Eve, with a Christmas special, cozy, fireside, chatty sort of Christmas special with maybe some music playing in the background, the sound of embers popping, chestnuts roasting, etc. And we're going to have a number of guests, including our friend Gadius Maximus, Rich Hauck is going to drop in, Sam Dixon, a whole parade of interesting people who are going to share some Christmas memories and thoughts. And then a week after that, it will be New Year's Eve, and we're going to do the same thing. Jim is going to be back, and we will have also Horace the Avenger, Tim Murdoch will be on, Sam Dixon will come back. I'm sure I'm forgetting a number of other people. Cyan is going to be joining us. So it'll be, again, just short segments with a lot of interesting people that you've come to know and love through Countercurrents. And tomorrow, please tune in for the Writer's Block. The guest tomorrow for the Writer's Block with Nick Gilvey is Blair Cottrell from Down Under. And he's going to be talking about Thomas Saz's book, The Myth of Mental Illness, with Nick Gilvey. So tune in tomorrow for that. And that begins at 1 o'clock Pacific time, 4 o'clock Eastern time, 10 p.m. Central European time with the Writer's Block. So I want to thank Jim for coming on. I want to thank the listeners out there, the moderators and the donors. And I'm looking forward to being back next week.
Say one thing about Sam, if I can squeeze it in.
Yes,
Sam absolutely. Let me and Mrs. Goetz stay at a place that he has in Key West for a week last January. The other day she asked in her inimitable, and I can't really imitate it, it's Spanish inflected New Orleans accent. She said, what is this Sam? What does he think about Jews? But I don't think he likes me. She's like, I like this Sam.
That's so funny. Yeah. So you do take it a vacation once in a while. You've got to do that. We got to keep you in the fight. And one of the things that's absolutely necessary for the creative process is a little downtime.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, yeah. Jim, thanks again. It's been tremendous. And we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.
See y'all.